Good afternoon. We're ready for our third case today. But before we call it, I want to welcome especially our students from Madison Memorial High School. Would they stand, please? Good having you with us. You may be seated. The high school students are with us on a national award-winning program we have, sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students from across the state, public schools, private schools, homeschool children, and ask them if they'd wish to come to an oral argument, and if they do, we give them a summary of the case we're about to hear. They come and they meet with a justice assigned to for that day to meet with the students. The discussion is on the procedures of the court, not the substantive matter and issue involved in the cases. And the Madison Memorial High School students, I gather, did meet at lunchtime with the justice. Let me introduce the court to all of you. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Robensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks, and you met with him at lunchtime. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Mm-hmm. To Justice Bradley's right is Justice David Prosser. And to his right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our third case, which is 2013 AP 1108 CR State versus Delabro. Arguing on behalf of the defendant Delabro is Attorney Stephen P. Hurley, who has 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal, and Jacob Whitwer, Assistant Attorney General, has 30 minutes between Attorney Hurley's two appearances. Mr. Hurley.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. I believe that this case can be resolved for two reasons that are probably not the reason that this court granted review of this case. And they are that the interrogation in this case was not in good faith compliance with the then extant law. And secondly, that there was not a valid and effective waiver of the right to counsel. I'd like to take those in that order. The U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Montejo held pretty clearly that the Sixth Amendment does not presume that the right to counsel has been invoked. But in this case, there was a very clear invocation of the right to counsel. Counsel represented to the court at the hearing on this matter that while his recollection wasn't precisely clear, it was the practice of his office that either he or a representative of his office would have met with the accused prior to the initial appearance, and at that time would have secured the accused's acceptance of their offer of counsel. And subsequently, at the initial appearance, the accused indeed accepted that offer of counsel.
Was the same attorney then representing him going forward as who appeared with him at the initial appearance?
No, Your Honor. At the initial appearance, the attorney, I believe, was Mr. Fitzgerald, and he advised the court at that time that he was looking for the prosecutor to inform him about whether there would be a conflict in the case. The arrest in this case had been part of a multiple arrest of various people. And so the public defender's office at that time didn't know whether it had any of the others who were arrested as clients at that time or from prior occasions. Neither the state nor the defense argue in this case that the instant defendant was unrepresented. He was represented. Subsequently, another counsel was appointed to represent him in the matter that comes before this court.
When you say he was represented, I'm sure you know from my sole performance in Forbush that I see Forbush as a case where you have to show that the defendant exercises right to counsel, and if you personally chose your counsel, I consider that exercising the right. And here I question you because this was a court-appointed counsel, and I am wondering about the evidences of choosing by your client. Do you know what I mean? Choosing with...
Yes, and I hope Your Honor's not suggesting that anyone who is without means to hire their own lawyer is judged differently.
No. It depends on if you're really exercising your right to counsel.
And that's why I emphasize the Mr. Fitzgerald's representation of the court about the practice of the office, that prior to that initial appearance, the accused in this case was offered the assistance of counsel, and he said quite explicitly, it is not our practice to represent anyone who chooses not to have us. And in this case, the accused chose that representation.
Okay, thanks.
Can I just ask you sort of a background piece of information? My recollection as a trial court judge was that often people might come in on an initial appearance, and often a representative from the public defender would appear with them in court. Not if they said, I don't want you here, but pretty much everyone says, yeah, help me through this first year. I don't know, you know, what's going on, whatever. Even if they don't, it's nice to have a lawyer sitting next to them, bond is set, read the complaint, find out, whatever. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
Are you suggesting that when that public defender sits there with 20 people for an initial appearance and setting bond, that that public defender then is counsel for all those people? Because, I mean, oftentimes they come back and they're not with the public defender, or you set it over for them to meet and see if they qualify, or you set it over for them to come back and ask the court for counsel, or you give them a chance to hire their own counsel. I guess while I recognize counsel was present for the purpose of that hearing and that day, I was often viewed it as sort of a limited appearance. They're appearing for purposes of helping them through that hearing that day, not that they intended to represent the 20 people in custody.
Well, I'll share with you two thoughts. One is, I don't think it turns on whether counsel intended to represent. I think it turns on what the expectation of the accused is.
Right. It makes a difference whether he's represented by counsel or whether he wished to someday be represented by counsel, don't you think?
But he is represented by counsel at the moment. There are many times in my career, more than I'm, you know, proud to announce before the court, that I appeared with someone at the initial appearance, and they subsequently changed their mind and hired somebody else. But when I appeared with them at that initial appearance, I was representing them in that matter.
That's
for,
right.
For all purposes, and that is my obligation as an attorney, is to represent them well within the context of the entire case before them.
But, were you a public defender or as a private lawyer? I mean, a public defender can't represent just anyone that they want to. They have to qualify and... I'll stop interrupting you.
How's that? It's quite all right. I just want to make sure that I understand clearly.
I guess I kind of viewed that as they weren't representing all 20 people until the end of time. Oftentimes they were there for the purpose of that hearing, knowing that that person was going to come back and maybe ask for a lawyer, or that person was going to meet with the PD and see whether or not they would take the case or assign it out, or whether they'd ask the court for a lawyer, or maybe they might even hire their own lawyer. Or they might decide to go on their own after that point. But I never really thought of it as that one lawyer is their lawyer then throughout that entire case for all 20 people. mean, because that's a lot of, I just didn't.
I have to tell you that my malpractice insurer would disagree with you, because that lawyer is on the hook for the representation of all of those people.
And that might be, I mean, I don't know if it's the same for the public defender. Maybe they would want to change their practice if they thought that then they're appearing and representing people till the end of time.
They are there at the initial appearance because a determination has been made, at least by their office, that they qualify for representation because the person has accepted that representation. And it may be that a different lawyer from their office will subsequently represent them, or it may be that they have to appoint someone. And it may be that any accused changes his mind and raises funds and says, I want to hire a private lawyer. In that very latter case, there's no way that anybody could know of that in advance. But it doesn't change the fact that they are represented by counsel at that moment and going forward. From that initial appearance, that counsel is obliged to the court to represent that person until the court releases that person from representation. They can't simply not show up the next time. So there is an understanding at that initial appearance that at least the public defender's office, in the form of some person, perhaps not the same one, will be representing them going forward.
If I understand your position from your briefs, here you do have a lawyer appointed, an actual person, was with the defendant at a court hearing. This was a commission, but I assume that's a court hearing, right?
Yes.
And that's different than Montejo, where he didn't have a lawyer appointed yet. The court said, we're going to get you a lawyer, and he hadn't had an appearance yet.
That's correct. And it's different.
You would therefore limit Montejo.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
You would therefore limit Montejo to that situation, or at least it doesn't cover your situation.
One can limit Montejo.
Right. And
I'll share my thoughts with the court. With a plurality opinion before me, I'm not about to tell anybody what they should be doing.
Right. Yeah. I would count your votes carefully. Right.
It is a stronger case in this case than it was in Dagnall and Forbush. Because in Dagnall and Forbush, we're dealing with someone who had counsel briefly in another state who were questioned during their transport to this state before any appearance in court. But here we have the meeting with a lawyer prior to the in-court appearance, or a representative of the lawyer, depending on whether Mr. Fitzgerald was remembering correctly or just remembering the process, and then subsequently his appearance in court with that person.
See, I think Dagnall is much different. I mean, Jim Connors went and talked to the police before they went down to Florida to get him, say, I've been hired to represent Dagnall. Don't talk to him when you transport him back.
Right.
So, I mean.
But that was in the context of speaking to them even before there had been an appearance in court. And therefore,
he was represented.
Mr. Connors hadn't even entered his appearance in court. But in this case, the appearance is entered, and it's public, and it is a matter of public record that Mr. Fitzgerald represents him. And that knowledge of his representation is imputed to the state's agents once the charges have been brought. And that is a holding of Michigan and Jackson, which was not overruled by Montejo. So we have an imputation of that knowledge to the state's agent. And indeed, we have an agent in this case who closed his eyes, as we've said in the brief, consciously avoided making a determination about whether there was representation in this case. Detective Ehrenstein, when asked, said he couldn't remember whether he had checked CCAP. So he wasn't exactly denying that he had, but said that he didn't recall learning that the accused in this case had been represented. He had had conversations with the district attorney. He had referred the matter for prosecution. In the course of questioning him, paperwork was mentioned, which could only have referred to the charges. And so here we have, at a minimum, the imputation of knowledge, perhaps conscious avoidance of the knowledge of that representation.
What do you do with the trial court finding? Didn't the trial court make a finding that he didn't know?
The trial court made a finding that he didn't know, but the trial court did not say whether he consciously avoided that, and the record certainly seems to suggest that. But in any event, the trial court erroneously found that the knowledge of representation could not be imputed to him, and it is imputed to him in the law. And at the time, Dagnall was controlling. Now, the state responds to that by saying, well, Forbush had been decided by the Court of Appeals. But the matter was pending decision by this court at the time of questioning. And the Attorney General's office and prosecutors and police ought to have known that this was not a settled question, that Dagnall was still the law. In its brief, the state suggests that, gosh, you know, the Attorney General's office was at that time teaching all of these officers that you could go ahead and do this. And it turns out that its anticipation of Forbush was incorrect, and frankly, wishful thinking doesn't make right. You know, it's a neat trick to teach everyone what isn't the law in the hope that if the law is then broken, they can say, gee, I did it in good faith. You really can't sanction that. So what we had was the precedent of this court of Dagnall that was controlling at the time. We had a proper, I believe, invocation of the right to counsel. We had the appearance in court with counsel. We had the imputation at a minimum of that knowledge to the police officer. And the police officer went ahead and questioned. And this court can reverse the decision of the appellate court on that basis alone. But additionally, in this case, there isn't a valid waiver. Now, in Montejo, Justice Scalia suggests that a Miranda warning suffices. And he also invites states to depart from their interpretation if they so choose. And I think this court must choose to do so. This court has said repeatedly over the years, perhaps most recently and clearly in the Klesig case, that the waiver of the right to counsel at a critical stage of the proceeding, which the state concedes the post-charging interrogation is, that the waiver must be knowing and intelligent. Were such a waiver to occur in court, this court has said that the court must be assured that there was a deliberate choice to proceed without counsel, that the accused was aware of the difficulties and disadvantages of self-representation, was aware of the seriousness of the charge or charges against him, and was aware of the general range of penalties that could have been imposed on him. In this case, the officer said, you have a right to counsel, and the defendant thereafter spoke. Now, there isn't a judge in this courtroom, nor in any courtroom in this state, that would accept the admonition, you have a right to counsel, as sufficient to find a waiver of counsel. If we can do this at the jail, then a police officer could say, do you waive the right to a preliminary hearing? Do you waive the right to a jury? Do you waive the right to a trial? And that would be sufficient. It wouldn't happen that way because each of those latter rights to be effective in court has to be affirmed by the court itself, and the court will make inquiry. Now, every day, I or other defense lawyers in this state meet with our clients, and we advise them of their right to a preliminary examination or their right to a jury trial or their right to a trial. And we fill out a form with them, and we make sure that they understand what their rights are and what they are giving up. And we can't just tell the court we did this. The court wants to look at that document and question the accused about it before the court accepts those waivers.
Counsel, if I take your argument, and maybe I misunderstood what you just said. You said saying you have a right to counsel, which is what Miranda does, giving that information, is not sufficient to waive the right to counsel.
That's correct.
Well, if that's the case, when someone is charged and they haven't made their initial appearance, so they're not represented by an attorney, you would still then be arguing that they have to waive their right to counsel aside from the Miranda warnings when they want to be questioned?
Once they are charged but do not yet have an attorney?
Yeah, when they're Sixth Amendment.
Once the adversary process is begun, they are entitled to counsel.
I don't disagree with you.
And this court has consistently said that the waiver of that right must be knowingly and intelligently made. And has defined what that means.
But we have in the past permitted people that have been charged and not yet appeared to be interrogated, so their Sixth Amendment right is there, and they've been given Miranda warnings, which I know arise under the Fifth, but we've used them in the Sixth as well. So if I buy your argument, it's not going forward going to happen then, right?
I'm going to dodge the question to this extent.
I'll just come back again. You know that.
I believe that if the right to counsel has attached under the Sixth Amendment, there is only one way to waive it, and that is knowingly and intelligently. And merely saying to someone, you have the right to a lawyer, does not assure any court looking at it subsequently that there has been a knowing.
Miranda says a little more than that, but that is the essence. It says more than that.
It says you have the right to a lawyer, and if you can't afford one, one will be appointed. But it doesn't tell them anything about the difficulties of self-representation. It doesn't tell them anything about how that relates to a trial, the advantages and disadvantages of proceeding with counsel. Doesn't tell them anything about the range of penalties that are involved. And I'm not suggesting to you that, as with other waivers of rights at critical stages of the proceedings, that we haul the person in front of a judge to assure that the right to counsel is properly waived. But I am saying that there must be a sufficient record made at the time, which a court can subsequently review, as it does review the advice I give my counsel about waiving preliminary exams or trials or juries, so that the court can make a finding that something has been waived. And that is wholly absent in this case. There is nothing written. There is no written waiver of rights.
Did they record the conversation where his Miranda warnings were given?
They did record the conversation. And he said, you have a right to counsel. If you can't afford one, one will be appointed. A warning which I must say, in the context of this case, is confusing, since he already had counsel and was aware that counsel potentially had a conflict. And then the defendant says, I want to talk to you. Nothing about what the meaning of this right was that he just waived.
Didn't you change the facts a little bit? Did Mr. Aronson, whatever the name is,
Detective Aronstein.
Okay. Did he initiate the contact?
A difficult question to answer. The testimony was by Detective Aronstein that about a week prior, the accused had sent him a note saying he wanted to meet with him. The note was never produced. The trial court accepted that as true. But in that week, the accused was brought to court and accepted counsel.
It seems to me this is a different fact situation than the Forbush case, where clearly, if memory serves me correctly, the police initiated contact with the defendant who had been charged. Here there is a request for the officer to come and talk to the defendant. Now, some things happen. You sort of brilliantly laid this out. But there was an initiation here. What was as soon as the defendant was charged, was the officer to disregard that prior request?
Under Dagnall, yes. I would suggest to the court.
That's another little thing here. You take it as an article of faith that Dagnall was still applicable. Do the police follow Dagnall or do they follow Montejo?
Well, that's what this court was trying to resolve in Forbush.
But the facts of the case were before Montejo.
The facts of the case were before Montejo. And while Forbush was still telling every lawyer in the state that this was an open question because of the status of Forbush, as having been argued in the court but left undecided. So one can't be informing officers during this period of time. And by the way, while the state suggests that the Attorney General's office was teaching officers that one could proceed on Montejo, this particular officer never testified that he got that advice. But nonetheless, it was an open question at the time. And one has to go with the clearest pronouncement of this court, if for no other reason than out of having some respect for stare decisis. And the officer ought not have gone, but if he did, and if this court were to find that in the circumstances of this case that that was okay, the waiver that was affected was not a proper waiver. It was not knowingly and intelligently made, nor is there any record of a knowing and intelligent waiver of the right to counsel.
Is there ever such a record? All they do is record it. I mean, what else would you have them do? They ask them about it. They sign the sheet.
The police officer can have someone fill out the same form that I fill out with my client so that a court can look at it subsequently and say, yes, I think you did know what you were doing. But to simply say you have a right to counsel, and if you can't afford one, one will be appointed for you, doesn't reach any of the elements of Johnson versus Zerbst or the classic case and the precedents under this court. It simply does not.
Justice Bradley?
No, I was going to ask the question that Justice Rogensack referred to, and that is that if the Miranda warning is insufficient, what, if anything, can the officer do? And you just, if anything, that would be the answer, if anything.
Piece of paper I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm sorry, Your
Honor. The piece of paper you're referring to is the plea questionnaire, is that right?
In the case of a guilty plea, yes. There's another questionnaire for waiving a preliminary examination.
Okay. What case would you cite for the proposition that once charged, no attorney is there yet, but you get Miranda, it's waiver?
That if you get Miranda, it's waiver? It was sufficient for Justice Scalia within the federal system.
Is that Montejo?
Yes.
Okay. But what about a Wisconsin case?
I don't believe I can cite you one.
Well, I asked you that because one of the questions was, but that's Wisconsin law. Once charged, but you don't have an attorney yet, but you get a Miranda, so you have the Sixth Amendment in effect, right? But you don't get an attorney yet.
Yes.
And you get a Miranda warning, that's a knowing and intelligent voluntary waiver, assuming you.
I don't believe this court has answered that question.
And Dagnall would go the other way, maybe, depending on whether you thought he had a lawyer or not.
Perhaps.
Okay. I just wanted to check to see if I was missing something.
No, I don't believe the court has answered that question yet.
And this one is not that question because he did have a lawyer.
Yes.
Okay. Would your answer be any different if public defender just met up with him in court and said, I can defend you at this hearing. I may not be able to stay with you for the entire proceeding, but are you willing to do that, or do you want to represent yourself?
Right.
Possible.
My answer would be no different.
From asking?
I don't know whether this is myself or my own interpretation of the rules of professional responsibility, but if I undertake representation of something, of someone, it can't be for just a part. I'm not permitted to do that. And as I said, no court would permit the attorney to not show up subsequently without first having filed a motion to withdraw, which the court could accept or not.
Well, we have limited representation now, but it's under a rule, and there are all sorts of procedural rules within that. And I know that when we had it before us, we had a discussion of whether it applies in criminal cases and how, and I guess we generally thought that in criminal cases you might have one at a bail hearing, one lawyer and another lawyer at a prelim, and then a third lawyer at the trial, and that's sort of accepted in the criminal area rather than in the civil, but maybe not.
I'm not sure that is a wise choice.
No, I didn't say it was wise. I said it happens.
Stuff happens, but civilly, and if we look at the civil side of this, there's not a lawyer in the world who would be let off the hook civilly on the claim that I only undertook representation for this tiny little piece.
Unless you fall within that rule and it's all been approved. Okay. Mr. Early, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Whitwer, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Oh, may it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Jake Whitwer representing the state of Wisconsin in this matter. I guess what I'd like to do here today to begin is to bring the court's attention back to the two issues that are presented in this case. First, whether a Miranda waiver is sufficient for a person who has been charged and is represented by counsel to waive his or her Sixth Amendment right to counsel. And second, whether the protections offered under Article 1, Section 7 of the Wisconsin Constitution are the same as the Sixth Amendment in this context. The state's answer to those two questions are, first, the Sixth Amendment issue in this case is controlled by Montejo v. Louisiana, as at least 5 members of this court already recognized in State v. Forbush. Under Montejo, police may request a custodial interview with a person who has been charged and who is represented by counsel at an initial proceeding, and a standard Miranda waiver is sufficient for that person to waive his or her Sixth Amendment right to counsel. Second, the state constitution, Article 1, Section 7, is the only avenue available for this court to conclude either that police cannot request an interview with a person charged and represented by counsel, or that, and this seems to be Delabrew's primary argument, that additional warnings or procedures must be grafted onto Miranda in this situation. Only 2 members of this court in Forbush read the state constitution to provide greater protection than the relevant portions of the Sixth Amendment in this context, and no prior case has construed Article 1, Section 7 in this manner, and there is very little in the text, the history, or the purpose of this provision to show that it offers greater protections than the Sixth Amendment. And I guess I would just conclude my opening remarks by encouraging the court to view this case as an opportunity to clarify for the bench, bar, and law enforcement the standards that are applicable to interviewing folks who have been charged and are represented by counsel.
Okay, so what is your standard? You got somebody who has been charged. That's true in this case, right?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. He is represented by counsel. Do you have any doubts about that?
Right.
He is represented.
He is represented by counsel.
Appeared in court with counsel.
Appeared in court with counsel.
Nothing in the record that would indicate counsel the following day. It was April 15th, right? He appeared in court April 14th. Nothing in the to indicate that counsel was fired in that interval.
Nothing to indicate that, no. The state has assumed that counsel
was still representing him.
Still representing
Okay.
him.
Now, who initiated this conversation, and does it matter? Under Montejo, does it matter?
Sure. I'll answer your first question.
Okay.
From the record and based on the factual findings of the trial court, it was the defendant in this case, before he was charged,
right.
Who apparently passed a note, wanted to speak with investigators.
Right. He was in jail on a parole hold.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay.
And then in the intervening time, he was charged and appeared in court on an initial appearance, and the following day he was interviewed by the investigator who received the note.
So who initiated it?
The initiation was from the defendant, which distinguishes this case from other cases. However, I think under a Montejo analysis, as I've argued in my brief, that fact is not relevant.
Yeah.
And that's because under Montejo, the investigator could approach and request an interview with the person after he appeared at the initial appearance by counsel.
And unless he then said, I don't want to talk to you unless my counsel is here, the police officer can go right ahead, talk to him, give him Miranda, and everything is okay with the world under Montejo.
That's correct. If, of course, in this case, Delabrue had said after either before the warnings were read or while the warnings are being read, I'm sorry, I have a lawyer, I'm not supposed to talk to you, or I don't want to talk to you, I have a lawyer, then it's done. Then the protections of Edwards v. Arizona kick in, and the person can't be interviewed subsequently unless they reinitiate an interview.
Unless the defendant, the accused,
reinitiates. Right, right.
What policy is advanced in a situation where the defendant is represented by counsel in court, a court appearance, and then subsequently is interviewed by a detective after giving the Miranda warning? What policy is advanced by that conclusion that it's okay?
In Montejo, the court explains that that the justification for the only justification for Michigan v. Jackson's rule that Montejo overruled was to protect the individual against police badgering. And the court concluded that the Miranda regime that's already in place, which includes Miranda, the warnings, Edwards of Arizona can't reinitiate once the right to counsel has been asserted, and Minnick, which reinforces the Edwards protections, that's the policy that the court decided was behind Michigan v. Jackson.
Do you take issue with the assertion that the knowledge is imputed to the state agent, that the defendant has appeared with an attorney and has an attorney?
I have two answers to that question.
Give me the best one.
The best one.
Or the
okay.
better of the two, I'm sorry.
Okay. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in this situation. And the reason it doesn't is because police, under Montejo, under the Sixth Amendment, had the opportunity to request an interview, even if they knew that he was represented by counsel. So
let me play this out, then.
Sure.
If you're in the middle of a murder trial, defendant's in the middle of a murder trial, and after the third day of the murder trial, he's in his cell, and it's well-publicized. Everyone, not just law enforcement, everyone knows of this local murder trial. Then the officers under Montejo can approach the defendant in a cell, give a Miranda warning, and question the defendant without counsel.
First of all, this court is not required in this case to answer that difficult question, and I'm not sure that Montejo necessarily answers that question because of the fact situation in Montejo. You're dealing with an initial appearance where a person is represented at the initial appearance, and that language is used throughout the opinion.
What about my hypothetical? What's your answer?
I'm not sure. I honestly don't know, and I don't know that a case has addressed that issue.
No, but why don't you apply the policy? As I understand the policy in overruling Jackson is that you have to balance the constitutional right to counsel at critical stages, which is, starts at the very beginning, clearly through trial, sentencing. You balance that against the police officer's need to ferret out crime and protect public safety, right?
Right.
And they make the balance in Montejo and say, hey, counsel fails. It takes a third place when there are only two policies, but it's really not that important, right? So why are you balking at trial? I mean, come on. The policy is still the same. The balance is still the same. So what are you going to balance? Because you know that he's got counsel? Well, we know that here. That it's more critical at trial? Well, it's critical here. Is it because the police may find out something that will be able to be used by the prosecutor during trial that against the best interests of the defendant and against his client as a lawyer? I mean, what's the balance?
Right. I guess when you're at trial and the adversarial proceedings are at their peak, if you will, I can see your point that the policy justification for Michigan v. Jackson may well be clearer in that fact situation than it is, at least in this situation. But again, the Supreme Court hasn't addressed a fact situation like that, and this court isn't either. It's an interesting question, but I don't think it's necessary for to answer that question to come to a conclusion in this case.
Isn't the answer that it applies to all critical stages? And this interrogation is deemed a critical stage after commencement?
No, no one disputes. The state absolutely agrees that interrogation is a critical stage, and the right to counsel exists at interrogation. In fact, Montejo says that itself in citing Moulton and in citing Messiah. But the issue in this case is what's sufficient to waive that right. And the court, the Supreme Court, answered that question in Montejo by saying that a Miranda waiver was sufficient to waive that right. And this court, five justices of this court, agreed that that was the case to waive the Sixth Amendment right. And so the second question here is whether the Wisconsin Constitution provides greater protections, because that's really the only avenue under which this court can either graft additional requirements onto Miranda, and I have to say that I would strongly discourage this court from going that route, because I think that's a dangerous road to go down. Miranda is foundational. Pardon me?
Dangerous to whom?
I think it's dangerous to our entire system, because Miranda is a foundational decision. And if we start to say that in this particular situation, Miranda waiver isn't sufficient to waive the right, then that just begs the question, what other situations isn't Miranda sufficient?
Well, even if you get a Miranda warning in the Fifth Amendment context, okay, even if you get a Miranda warning, the defendant can still make the argument that it wasn't a knowing and intelligent and voluntary waiver. It's not the end of the story that you
Absolutely.
Get a Miranda. So to say that you can challenge the Miranda waiver, hey, we're not bringing down the whole court system or the criminal justice system, because you can do that now under the Fifth Amendment, right?
Well, certainly a person in an individual situation can say that my Miranda waiver was not
right.
valid.
Oh. Right.
What I'm talking about here is this court, under its own constitution, deciding to graft additional procedures or additional warnings onto Miranda. And in
the Sixth Amendment perspective, in the Sixth Amendment.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, of course, as a majority
of the... And Scalia said, oh, there's nothing the matter with that. States should do as they see fit under their procedures, right? He didn't think the world was going to come to an end.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Why do you?
I don't believe that the world is going to come to an end. But I do think that it's a dangerous road to go down to start to say that in this particular situation that Miranda, which, again, is foundational, is insufficient for a person to make a valid waiver of their right under the Fifth or Sixth Amendment. And again, as a majority of this court, as five justices this court concluded in Forbush, that waiver is the same. The Fifth Amendment and the Sixth Amendment rights are waived through the same process. They're the same under United States Supreme Court precedent.
The real question is, should they be?
Perhaps, but again, that's... You need to do that under the state constitution to reach a different conclusion.
You don't think it's against the law for this court to look to its own constitution, do you?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I wanted to address a question from Justice Rogan's concern. I do think that the factual situation in this case is distinguishable from Forbush. For the first time, I believe, here at oral argument, I could be wrong, it may be in the brief, but it didn't ring a bell for me. Counsel has asserted that, based, I think, on the transcript, that it's the policy of the practice of the office of the person who represented Delabrew here, that they won't accept anyone who doesn't accept representation from them. I don't think that's sufficient to establish that the person actually affirmatively asserted their right to counsel in that situation. I believe that what we have on this record is that the counsel was appointed, and that's what distinguishes this case from Forbush, at least under your analysis, Justice. Yeah.
Well, you can have appointed counsel if, in fact, you request it and it's provided at your request. I read Forbush as, what does it take to exercise the Sixth Amendment right to counsel? And if you hire someone affirmatively, you've exercised your right to counsel by saying, will you represent me? I'm going to pay you money to represent me. You can, I believe, do the same thing with appointed counsel by asking for it and then meeting with counsel and saying, yes, I want you to represent me. So I think you can do it either way. But you don't think there's any facts in the record that would show an exercise of right to counsel under what I've just said?
I think that's correct. I think that's correct. And, again, it's the state's position, however, and we would depart somewhat from your analysis in Forbush that...
Everybody did. Stand in line. I don't believe it, obviously, but anyway.
Right, right. Is that...
If all we had was
Dagny... Can you finish, please?
Oh, were you done or no? I'm sorry.
Your position was that you didn't necessarily agree with Justice Robinsack's position because...
I believe that under Montejo, and Montejo overruled Jackson and established a... And thereby overruled Degnall. In the state's view, the state agrees with the interpretation of Justice Crooks and your dissent, and the Chief Justice and Justice Bradley in your concurrence.
So you think Montejo just said it doesn't matter if you are retained, if you have retained counsel, and that you've exercised your right to counsel, we can still give you Miranda warnings anyway, and you can step outside that.
I believe that's the case. Yeah, I believe.
Right. Okay. Well.
Yeah. Well.
It's a lot of pressure, frankly, on a defendant, often who are uninformed about the law, to retain an attorney even, and then the law enforcement comes in while they're in jail or confined in some way and says, "I want to talk to you. Here are your Miranda warnings. Do you waive them?" And if they waive them without counsel being there, they're out of luck for the counsel they retain, right? Boy.
Yeah.
You think it goes that far? Yeah?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, obviously, I still have some doubts about the breadth of Monteo. So,
all right, Justice Ziegler.
Under Dagnall, could law enforcement do what they did?
Probably not, because even though the request was made from the defendant, in the intervening time, the person was charged and was represented by counsel, and I think that's dispositive under Dagnall and would have been dispositive under Michigan v. Jackson as well.
So what of the good faith or no good faith, rather, argument that Mr. Hurley makes?
I'm puzzled because it's Monteo was the law at the time. The Court of Appeals decision held that Dagnall was overruled by Monteo. That was a published Court of Appeals decision. There was no order from this court staying the precedential effect of that Court of Appeals decision. And frankly, five justices of this court reached the same conclusion as the Court of Appeals. They just reversed as to the mandate. Five justices of this court concluded that under the Sixth Amendment, a waiver of a Miranda waiver is sufficient to waive the right to counsel when the person is represented and has been charged.
So it's your position, to follow up Justice Rogensack's question, if the facts here showed clearly and unequivocally that the defendant met with a public defender, the public defender said something like, you can represent yourself if you want, but if you want, our office and I will represent you. If the record clearly and unequivocally demonstrated that exchange, then the person was charged and appeared in court with that attorney. It's your position that the clear and unequivocal invocation really makes no difference, that law enforcement can still meet with him afterwards and give him a Miranda warning and then engage in interrogation. Is that correct?
That is correct, because that's the holding of Monteo, I believe. Mm-hmm. And again, that's what five justices of this court concluded in Forbush.
That's right, in Monteo, and then you're left with the state constitution.
Right.
If you have a different avenue.
Right, right.
Counsel, the Department of Justice, it seems to me, had educational materials on Dagnall.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Does it now have educational materials on Monteo that basically encourage people to go and talk to defendants who are represented?
Well, it has materials that describe the holding of Monteo and that indicate that that's permitted under Monteo and is certainly not prohibited by this court's decision in Forbush or any other Wisconsin court decision. Again, five justices of this court, Forbush, concluded that Monteo overruled Dagnall, and so police can approach a person who's represented by counsel for an interview.
Are there any cautionary notes in those descriptions?
Well, I've provided in the brief the section that is offered that explains Monteo, and it was very helpful to me as someone who doesn't do this particular area of the law all the time, to be reminded that that officers, once the right is asserted, once the right to counsel is asserted, they can't come back and talk to the person again. So that essentially means that officers have one chance to talk to a person who's in this position, who is represented by counsel. And all the person need do to protect themselves from any further interrogation is to say, I have a lawyer, and I'm invoking my right, or I don't want to talk to you. I have a lawyer. You can talk to my lawyer about this.
And does the DOJ material say, oh, you can only do it after an initial appearance, or only after a prelim that is in time, or does it say don't do it during trial? I just can't remember where it's in your brief.
Right, right. Yeah, let me see if I can locate it really quickly here. I don't believe that it includes such a warning, but I do want to make sure.
Let's see. It should be on either 22 or 34. That's
it's on 34. It's page 34 of my brief. No, it doesn't address that fact situation. Again, I appreciate the question, but again, that's not the fact situation that's presented in this case.
But your position, as I understand it, is that it is irrelevant under Montejo as to who initiates the conversation. Did I misunderstand your position?
To the extent, of course, that police can request an interview with someone who's mm-hmm. been charged, yes.
That's right. So right. The hypotheticals shouldn't be so difficult. I mean, that is, after someone is charged, after someone is in court with an attorney, and you agree that that information is imputed to the state agent, you've got an attorney. So the law enforcement knows, by purpose of imputation,
right.
Knows that there's an attorney. Your position is that the law enforcement then can go and initiate a conversation because under Montejo, it is irrelevant who initiates the conversation, as I understand it. Maybe I'm misunderstanding something.
Well, I think that Montejo deals with a fact situation where the person has just been charged and is about to be appointed counsel. I don't think that it deals with the fact situation that you presented in your scenario, and I'm not sure how the United States Supreme Court would decide that case.
Yeah. I thought you had said earlier that it is irrelevant who initiates the conversation.
Right, but the question, as I understand that you're asking, is the timing of that question. What if the request is during trial as opposed to immediately after being charged? And my answer to you on that is I don't know if the United States Supreme Court hasn't addressed a case like that.
Well, the instructions to the police are Montejo rejected the notion that no represented defendant can ever be approached by the state and asked to consent to interrogation. The Montejo court determined that police can approach a charged and represented person to see if the person wishes to speak with the police. There's no time limit. You can interpret that any way you like.
That is the way that it appears, yeah. I'm not, again, it's not the fact situation that's presented in this case.
Mm-hmm. I understand.
And I appreciate the court's concern about that particular fact situation. I'm not here to argue that the result would be the same if we were dealing with a situation at trial.
I'm just going to inch up to it incrementally.
I don't know. Again, this case presents an opportunity for this court to clarify and to present a rule in a majority opinion that makes clear that the Sixth Amendment allows, under Montejo, an individual who has been charged and is represented by counsel to be approached for an interview. And it also provides an opportunity to clarify what a majority of the court also said, that the Wisconsin Constitution does not provide greater protections in this area. So
you'd want to say that the Sixth Amendment would say that an individual charged and represented can be approached for an interview before trial.
I would not be opposed to that language.
Or just after an initial appearance. That's a timing issue.
Right, right. That's the language that's used in Montejo. I mean, there's references to an initial proceeding. So Again, I would discourage this court from grafting additional requirements onto Miranda in this situation. I think it's a judicially, CLASSIC is a judicially administered remedy, and by asking police officers to do a CLASSIC-like colloquy, you're essentially asking them to perform the function of a neutral magistrate, and I'm just not aware of any case law from any jurisdiction that requires that sort of process from the police. If CLASSIC were imposed in this situation, then police officers would have to inquire as to the person's, if they're aware of the seriousness of the charges, if they're aware of the range of penalties, and even ask questions as to their competency, their level of educational attainment, their mental health history, all the factors that judges make when determining whether to allow someone to proceed pro se at trial. I think that would be unprecedented, and I think that it goes beyond the scope of the police's function in our system. So,
any other questions?
If there are no additional questions, I'll stand on my briefs and thank you so much.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hurley?
A couple of things I want to clear up. Justice Bradley, there is an extant form for waiver of counsel which is employed in the circuit courts of this state. Justice Rogancek, you're not alone, perhaps alone among those who vote, but I don't disagree with the interpretation of Montejo that what the court is saying is that one may not presume an invocation of the right to counsel. In this case, the testimony of the defense counsel to which I referred will be found in the appellant's brief in the appendix in the transcript of pages 27 through 29. In this court's opinion in Forbush, there was concern about whether Wisconsin's interpretation of the Sixth Amendment right to counsel ought to be different from that of the federal constitution. I want to briefly address that. In the past, when this court has found interpreted a state analog in its constitution differently than the federal one, there have usually been four reasons, one of four reasons for it. Either there was different verbiage in the constitutions, there was a specific history of a provision in the Wisconsin Constitution which dictated a different interpretation. There was a history of practice under the provision which differed from the federal interpretation. And sometimes it was a question of who do we want to be. In this case, it's really the latter two that ought to influence this court. The history of practice in Wisconsin in cases dating back to 1850 with respect to the right of counsel, which we cite in the brief, it's a very long history and a very strong history in protection of the right to counsel. I must say that I disagree with the paradigm that Justice Scalia presents when he posits that the decision in Montejo is premised on a choice between good and evil, and those are his words, saying that police questioning is good, not an evil. It isn't a question of whether police questioning is good or not, or whether the protection of the right to counsel is good or not. Both are necessary, and both coexist. And in this state, I can tell you from my practice, the notion that these are constantly in conflict is not correct. I can't tell you the number of times that I and my colleagues have represented people and arranged for them to speak with police, either before charging and after charging. in cases as serious as homicide cases. Indeed, we did that just last week. The right to counsel doesn't mean that the client is never going to speak to the police. It means that when my client does speak to the police, he does so with his eyes open, understands the advantages and disadvantages of doing so, and he does so with me as an interface to make sure that the questioning will yield a result that is truthful. We do not have a history in this state of constant antagonism between counsel and police. And I don't think that the choice, viewing this as a choice between good and evil, is who we want to be. And so while I can agree with Justice Rogensack's opinion, I can also agree, too, that the foundation in the Wisconsin Constitution is particular and different in practice and in practice history here than perhaps Justice Scalia perceives the right to counsel in the federal context. I have nothing else to say unless you have any questions.
I would, just looking at 24 through 27 of the appendix and 27 through 29.
27 through 29.
Yeah. It seems as if they're doing a almost a stipulation that public defender went, saw him. He agreed to accept them as the attorney, that he was qualified as under the indigency standards. And the state seemed to say, okay, you can stop the questioning of Mr. Public Defender because we agree with all that.
It does appear that way, yes.
Let me, if you were sitting up here and you wanted to write an opinion to award Mr. Delabrew, Mr. Hurley and Company a victory.
I'm sorry.
A victory. Is there any way to do that without bringing in Article 1, Section 7?
I think you can find that there was invocation here and not go to the Wisconsin Constitution. I think you can find there was not a proper waiver without going to the Wisconsin Constitution. If one views Montejo in a context greater than I think Justice Scalia limited his opinion to, then the answer is no. I do think you have to go to the Wisconsin Constitution. But I think Justice Scalia's opinion was quite narrow. I think he said very clearly that this is a holding that says you cannot presume that there has been an invocation.
Well, does the back end apply that when you do have an invocation, that it has to be respected?
I don't know that that is clearly answered by Montejo.
Okay. Montejo, I was going to look. You describe at page 24 of your brief.
Now you're going to ask me about what I wrote.
Pardon me? Yeah,
no. You're going to ask me about what I wrote.
Okay. In Montejo, see if I can find it again. I guess I have to go find 24. He was arrested. He waived his rights under Miranda. He was interrogated under the Fifth Amendment, as I understand it. In the course of an afternoon and evening, I'm reading at the bottom of 24. And then, so far, so good. Okay? 3 days later, he's brought to a judge. and the minutes reflect he was charged with murder. He didn't appear with counsel, but the court ordered counsel to be appointed. I don't think he objected to appointed counsel. So court ordered counsel to be appointed. Later the same day, this is after he's been charged, after he's appeared in court, after the court says, you're getting counsel, and he doesn't object. Two detectives visit him in the jail, and then they want him to help him find the murder weapon, and they read him the Miranda warnings, and he says, well, I'm going with you, right? And Montejo writes an inculpatory letter of apology to the widow of the victim. And after he returns to jail, Montejo meets his court-appointed attorney. And he doesn't object to the court-appointed attorney then either, right?
That's correct.
Okay. So you can't presume invocation of counsel. What has he have after counsel's appointed in?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the
well,
last
what part. What did the judge accomplish by saying we're appointing counsel to you? And he doesn't say, I'm not taking any public defender or anyone else. I mean, I know why you want to read it narrowly, but, man, it's hard.
Yes, that's correct. I'm not going to beat around the bush. Yes, that's correct. But this is indeed a much clearer invocation.
That's for sure. Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to thank both counsel in yet another argument under Miranda and right to counsel. Probably everybody thought Miranda would be the answer to everything. Turned out it's not. 2013 AP 1108 CR State versus Jesse Delabro. We have now concluded the argument on that. Thank you both, and the court, as you know, takes it under advisement, and the court will meet in a closed conference at 3:15, and we are in recess until our next argument, which is next week sometime. We're in recess. Thank you.